Du lytter til Radio 24/7.
Velkommen til Aflyttet med Anders Kjærulf.
Velkommen til et program, der i ført skæg og blå briller, i hvert fald indeni, hvor der ruller et begreb rundt. Overvågningskapitalisme. Overvågningskapitalisme er skabt af den amerikanske forfatter Susanna Zuboff, og det dækker over den måde, som tech-giganterne tjener deres penge på, når de giver os gratis ting. Det gør de ved at overvåge os gennem data om vores opførsel og handlinger, og så bruge dem til at sælge os ting og manipulere os med. Men måske er det dybere end som så. Det mener David Murakami Wood, professor i sociologi og ekspert i overvågning, som jeg mødte i Bruxelles i februar. Vi talte længe om overvågning, smarte byer og netværk, og den samtale, den skal du høre nu, her i Aflyttet. Jeg hedder Anders Kjærulf. Velkommen til.
Whatever's that? Darling, it's not a book.
That's what it is, it's a novel.
Oh, but a book? Oh, you mustn't, it's against the law.
Quiet, sit down and listen.
Hi, I'm David Murakami Wood. I'm the Canada Research Chair in Surveillance Studies at Queen's University. Is that enough for a level?
David Murakami Wood er professor i sociologi ved Queen's University, Ontario, Canada. Og så er han ekspert i overvågning og smarte byer. Han har skrevet en Ph.D. ved navn The Hidden Geography of Transnational Surveillance, Social and Technical Networks Around the Signals Intelligence Sites. Den handler blandt andet om NSA, National Security Agency, den her hemmelige efterretningstjeneste, som Edward Snowden blandt andet har beskæftiget sig med.
I'm not somebody who rejects technology. There's certain kinds of technology I reject. I don't have a mobile phone at all. I'm not. This is kind of actually very inconvenient right now, especially when I can't access my email. but you know, it's the inconvenience is it reminds me sometimes of why I do this. It's the same reason I don't drive a car, and I have never driven a car. When I was 17, my parents gave me money to take driving lessons. I bought a bicycle. And every time I think about how inconvenient it is not to have a car, it reminds me of the decision-making process I made then and how important that was, you know, to do with the environment and to do with respect for, you know, other people and so on. And I have the same kind of ambivalence about mobile phones, but when I think about why I don't have one, I have to, again, remind myself of why that's the case, and it makes me think very consciously of my relationship to technology. And that might inconvenience me, but that inconvenience provides a constant reminder that I should be careful of my relationship with technology.
Lige nu, så er han lidt rastløs. Han er lukket ud fra sin mailkonto og kan ikke modtage en sms-kode, fordi han ikke har nogen mobiltelefon. Han har heller ikke nogen bil. Han har slettet sin Facebook-konto, men han er på Twitter. Det hele handler om, at det nogle gange er lidt svært at få det til at gå op, og så bliver det besværligt uden for eksempel en mobiltelefon, og det betyder, at han tænker over sit forhold til teknologi.
I deleted Facebook. I had Facebook for a long time, and I was always saying it's really funny a surveillance researcher has Facebook. And I thought, no, it's not actually that funny in the end. It stopped being funny. And I don't have that particular network. I'm on Twitter. That's actually the only social network I belong to. I actually got rid of LinkedIn a long time ago, which is one of the most awful social networks. This entirely corporate, soulless system that, yeah, it's. It's just horrible, but that kind. I've.
And you never had a mobile phone.
I never had a mobile phone ever. No. Well, no, I did. I have one several times in my life. I have had one, but yeah, it's not for the last 6-7 years. I haven't had one, and maybe longer actually.
You have a landline?
No.
No.
Not at home. No. I quite like the idea of when I'm at home in my community of. Being part of my community, and it's not that a landline wouldn't facilitate that, but you know, when I go home, I really feel at home.
Jeg mødte ham til Computers Privacy and Data Protection konferencen i Bruxelles i februar måned. Her var det helt store emne overvågningskapitalismen, et begreb, som er opfundet af en af David Woods kolleger, Susanna Zuboff, hvis 700 sider store bog blev præsenteret på konferencen, og som vi tidligere har kunne høre her i Aflyttet. Men David Wood har det lidt svært med overvågningskapitalismen som begreb.
Well, I'm ambivalent about the term, and it's quite surprising, given that I'm a surveillance scholar, that I would not welcome this. And I do welcome it, but I don't think it's completely explanatory. you know, first of all, I don't think a lot of the things that she outlines about what she calls surveillance capitalism, Professor Zuboff, are actually any different from capitalism as we know it, in some senses. And if they're so radically different in the way that she's describing by the end of the book, then I don't think it's capitalism at all. So we're in this strange kind of position where either it's just capitalism or it's not capitalism at all for me, I think. And then maybe it's useful as a transition phrase. I mean, we had a discussion last night about what happens, for example, if Google implements the kinds of plans that someone like Alex Pentland of MIT Human Dynamics Lab is interested in. This is so-called social physics. And the idea is that essentially you have a completely predictable social science that's more like physics or chemistry, where you can know exactly the movements of every person. You can predict precisely what everyone will think or want or do. And for someone like Pentland, this is the ideal society. It's like a perfectly ordered society. But I wonder, because, you know, a lot of Google's income, where Pentland sort of has worked and consults for, a lot of Google's income comes from this idea of betting on the future, essentially prediction products. And if there's no uncertainty, then there's no betting, right? You know what's going to happen. There's no profit to be made in betting on the future. So it's actually fundamentally contradictory with Google's current main business model, which is selling prediction products, you know, to people who want to sell to us. So either Google is deliberately undermining its own current business model to in the service of some greater project which it has. And some people believe that. Kevin Kelly, one of the founders of Wired, has said for a long time that Google's main business is making planetary expanded AI system, and that's all they want to do. And he says all the other stuff, the advertising, everything else, is just in the service of that ultimate goal. Whereas, you know, a lot of political economists and analysts, they say that, you know, Google's main business is advertising. And it seems that actually both those things are not entirely compatible. It may be that Google's original idea was to create, you know, some massive AI system, and it's become diverted into kind of conventional capitalism. I don't know, but it's those positions are not compatible. So eventually, if Google does create this perfectly predictable model of society, then perfectly predictive model of society, then it has no business anymore, in a sense. Maybe because it runs the world, there is no capitalism. Or, you know, if it does not, then that seems that idea that we are going to create a completely ordered model of society is just a fantasy.
Overvågningskapitalisme er et mudret begreb, mener Wood, der mener, det i virkeligheden bare er kapitalisme som sådan. Og han bruger Google som eksempel på, hvorfor overvågningskapitalisme ikke er dækkende for, hvad der foregår nu. Og hvis det er, så vil det ikke virke. Google lever af at sælge forudsigelser om fremtiden til deres kunder, annoncører og firmaer, men ifølge deres egen ledere, så er Googles mål det endelige mål at skabe en kunstig intelligens, der kan forudsige alt om fremtiden. Og hvis den intelligens virkelig kan det, så er der jo ikke mere at sælge til nogen, hævder altså David Murakami Woods. Men hvordan har han det generelt med den her verden af STEM, Science and Technology, vores politikers foretrukne vej til en fremtid, der er tungt og bredt belagt med kontrol og big data og algoritmer og forudsigelser om os alle sammen, lige fra om vi kunne finde på at blive terrorister, til mulig arbejdsløshed eller dårlig behandling af vores børn, alt sammen opnået ved hjælp af big data.
Well, this is one place where I really agree with Professor Zuboff. I think there's a process of dehumanization that's going on, and I've been saying this for a number of years. We have slightly different ways to describe the same phenomenon. I think we're moving towards a kind of what I call an ambient government, a kind of way in which our surroundings and things that we live with govern us. Essentially, we're told where to go, how to move, what to buy. And it's not as if I believe in the sort of myth, the American myth of the rugged individual who's, you know, completely self-created and no one can tell them what to do. But on the other hand, the idea that, you know, that there should be no possibility for people to create themselves and to create conditions for their own flourishing, individually or collective, is really a terrifying prospect. But I think it's closer now than we've ever had. These kind of warnings, people have made them for hundreds of years, right? That we'll have no free will, we'll be under control. You know, it's in the film The Matrix, all of this kind of stuff. It's not new. But I think at the moment, the at least the will is there among certain people within the technological development community to create the conditions for this kind of society. That in itself is disturbing, that people think that's a good idea. It's it's a very strange way of thinking to me that someone would think that is a great idea. On the other hand, I don't go as far as Professor Zuboff in saying that the answer instead is to kind of bring back a kind of complete individualism in some ways. I think we do need more collective and cooperative kinds of solutions. And, you know, I think this is one of the big differences between maybe a European way of thinking and an American way of thinking. I think we, in Europe, people who have a... And Britain is still in Europe at the moment, but maybe not for long. But I consider myself still a European, and the way I think is more European. That there's not a fear of collective solutions in Europe. There isn't a fear of, you know, people working together cooperatively, or of even of state solutions which, you know, provide for people. That's not a terrible thing, I think. But in the US, that's still, you know, basically, that's terrible socialism. And so there's a kind of fear of, you know, losing individualism to the collective, which is also a part of this book, which where I don't quite agree with, you know, that that's a terrible thing at all. I think we could do with actually, you know, losing some of the kind of extreme individualism that has made society go in such a direction that we're now indeed divided up and everything catered for and on some kind of individual consumer basis. And that, to me, is not a society of, you know, even if you are, but do believe in sort of individual freedom, that's not a society of individual freedom anyway. Of course, that's what Professor Zuboff is pointing out, but I don't think the answer is to recover some authentic, perfect individuality. I think we need collective solutions.
Systemerne dehumaniserer os, siger David Wood. Det er en proces, der har været i gang længe, og her er han enig med Susanna Zuboff. Manipulationen af borgerne bliver mere og mere massiv. Der har været masser af advarsler omkring det. Tænk på filmen The Matrix og mange andre. Vi har brug for mere kollektive løsninger, hvis vi skal bevare den individuelle frihed. Vi bliver bange for at miste vores individualitet til det fælles. Det er en vis grad Zuboffs agenda, og den er han faktisk ikke enig i, ham der Woods. Men hvad med kunstig intelligens? Her i Danmark vil regeringen bruge det i administrationen, blandt andet til at tage beslutninger.
If you look at what the tech companies are currently wants to provide and what a lot of governments are listening to them, if you look at the way they want to use artificial intelligence and stuff like that, they tell us that what they will bring us is ultimate mathematic justice.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very worried at the moment. The United States, there's a lot of use of AI-like products, and I hesitate to say AI because a lot of it's very basic. It's more very basic machine learning. And they're using this for sentencing, you know, for in courts, for deciding how long someone should go to prison. And these things are radically unfair. I mean, it's bad enough when you have judges who don't understand the conditions of someone's life, but essentially you're getting those kinds of prejudices, social prejudices embedded within technology, which masks the extreme unfairness of the system. And the idea is that technology is objective, but somehow a sentencing algorithm can bypass judicial bias and these kind of things. It's just the complete opposite, right? These things are made by people with biases. The biases are embedded in the system. The system learns to be more biased based on social biases. A lot of the ones that are learning systems, and we've seen this time and time and again with experiments that have done, the famous example of the Microsoft chat agent that was turned into a Nazi within 24 hours by, you know, interacting with people online. You know, it's... These systems learn from their surroundings, and that's not necessarily a good thing. Even systems that are controlled, they're programmed, and then systems that are learning learn from, you know, all that stuff that's out there online, which it's very easy to game for a start. But, you know, humanity is a cesspool of prejudices and biases, and to think that somehow a certain group of people programming systems will be able to overcome these and call them objective, it's just masking, you know, the way in which those biases get embedded in the systems.
There's no such thing as what we call objective programs.
I'm trying to imagine a process by which you would achieve such a thing. I mean, it's possible, I guess. You could start with a completely empty system that all it does is learn. And that's its only... You know, it has no direction apart from learning. And its end is left up to the system itself. I suppose you could imagine that. But even that would depend on who and how it interacted, right? And, you know, to say that would be objective by the end of the process would be very difficult. Anything else would have to involve some degree of direction from human programmers and human managers and trainers and so on. And decisions made about, for example, what is the database of objects or things that the system would interact with in order to be trained and to be calibrated. All of those are decisions made by people. or by other systems which are programmed by people. So there's no such thing as some perfectly objective computer system of any kind.
David Murakami Wood er bekymret over kunstig intelligens. I første omgang, fordi der slet ikke er tale om kunstig intelligens endnu, bare det, der hedder machine learning. Ved machine learning lærer computerne yderst forenklet via de data, de fodres med, men kun inden for en given ramme. Kunstig intelligens, der kan tænke selv, den er langt væk endnu. Machine learning er til gengæld allerede i brug i Danmark, men i den grad også i USA, hvor man er begyndt at bruge det til at tage stilling i retssager med katastrofale resultater, fordi systemerne er konstrueret med såkaldt bias, at de så at sige holder mere med nogen end andre, afhængig af de data, de er blevet trænet på. En ting er, at man har en dommer, der ikke forstår forskellige menneskers liv. Noget andet er, at man laver et system, der påstår at være uafhængigt og totalt retfærdigt, men er bygget på de fordomme, de, der har lavet dem, har. David Wood tror simpelthen ikke på ideen om et objektivt retfærdigt computersystem. Det kommer ikke til at ske, siger han. Men hvad med det der digitale samfund, det vi hele tiden bryster os af herhjemme, det vi angiveligt er verdensmester i? Kan demokratiet overleve det? Og hvem er det egentlig, der står bag den her globale digitale trend?
Do you see, is there somebody behind this system that actually knows what is going on?
That's a very good question. I think Professor Zuboff's book is really valuable in drawing attention to exactly that process that's happening. But as to whether there's one person, I mean, there are various examples that we could point to about of people who are particularly evil within this context. I mean, at the risk of having your radio station sued, Peter Thiel, for example, I think, you know, is the embodiment of pure evil. This is the guy who funds and runs Palantir, which is one of the most intensive private surveillance companies in the world. He also sits on the board of Facebook, by the way. And he's also the guy who invested in this company in California that the idea was to extract the blood from younger people so that tech bros could actually, you know, have this young blood injected into them so they could live forever. I mean, this is a real startup company. These kinds of projects are crazy, and these kinds of people involved in them, these are not the kind of people, you know, if you had a choice to elect anyone, that you would elect, right? Peter Thiel, in this sense, maybe is a literal vampire. It's like, that's not a very good platform for standing for election, right? Elect me, I will drink your blood.
But, you never know. It probably works somewhere.
Maybe. Well, yeah, I mean, it's pretty much Trump's, you know, agenda, wasn't it? It's like, he's not hiding how awful he is. But I think there is, you know, this is one of the problems, right? Actually, mentioning Trump draws one of the problems here is that at the moment there's a crisis of democracy that's led to people putting their trust in very unsuitable people to run, you know, to run countries. So it looks like democracy itself is already in crisis, right? We have the election of essentially authoritarians, of violent and vicious people who promise, you know, to kill people. Duterte in the Philippines, that was his platform. I will kill drug dealers. You know, he boasted that he had personally thrown drug dealers out of helicopters. That was his election platform. And, you know, if people like that are getting elected, you know, there is certainly a problem with democracy already before we get to the threat to democracy from outside technological sources. So the problem for me is that technology-related solutions, and I'm thinking here about the kinds of attitudes of people like Mark Zuckerberg, who is very, very clear about his ambitions for Facebook. You know, he really believes that Facebook is the answer to the world's problems. You know, he published a manifesto last in 2017, the Open Letters to the Facebook Community, which is essentially a political manifesto, which argues that Facebook can run the world better than other companies and better than governments, given the chance. And the problem is that things like that start to look very attractive when you're confronted with leaders like Duterte, Bolsonaro, Trump. You know, if that's the what politics is giving us, what democracy is giving us, then suddenly that kind of techno-based, techno-communitarianism, I call it, suddenly looks very attractive. It looks like this might actually be better than what democracy is delivering. And that's a really dangerous prospect. The idea that somehow our choices are, on the one hand, violent, nativist, fascism of various kinds, and on the other hand, a purely sort of technologically driven new communitarianism where it's not really democracy, we just, you know, take part in a sort of technologically ordered set of community programs of various kinds. But the danger is that's where it's going. We find it very difficult to, I think, collectively think about more than two solutions at a time. And that's kind of, if that's what's presented to people, sometimes I say, yeah, well, I'll take Facebook, you know, it's better than Trump. And I think that's Zuckerberg's politics, right? He knows that. He's not he's not a fan of Trump at all. And I think the election of Trump was a big shock to some of the more liberal members of the technological community. Some, like Peter Thiel, were right on board. Great. But, like, you know, I think for Zuckerberg, I think he's genuinely troubled by people like Trump. You know, he's not exactly the most perceptive person politically, but I think he's troubled by that, and I think he really genuinely feels that he can do better. And people have talked about him running for president, but I don't think it's about that. I think it's about setting up Facebook as an alternative to politics altogether and to government altogether. And I think his move into especially the global south with things like Free Basics and trying to associate Facebook with the internet as a whole shows his ambition. Right? He really wants to put Facebook as a layer over everything. Now, that seems ridiculous now, given the trouble that Facebook has got into in the last 2 years. But I think, despite all that scandal, that remains his ambition. But he's, of course, only one example. It doesn't mean if there is a move to this kind of information, technology-driven communitarianism that it will be Facebook that implements it. Facebook might go the way of MySpace, or they're trying very hard not to go that way by buying WhatsApp and Instagram and all this kind of thing. But it might be some other company. But I think that impulse that there's somehow a kind of a new whole system of government that can emerge out of technological platforms, whether it's Facebook or something else, that impulse is there. It's dangerous, but it's dangerously attractive in a time when we're confronted by, you know, radical far right nativism and violence as the alternative. So I think the most important thing right now, for anybody, not just people like me who are technological critics and technocritics, is to establish the fact that there are still alternatives to both of these things. And so our arguments have to deal with, on the one hand, the threat or the prospect of fascism and the resurgence of this nostalgic far right, and on the other hand, this idea that somehow we can have this objective, technologically oriented and organized society. Both of these things are things we have to oppose at the same time. And this is where I think Professor Zuboff's book is really vital, is that it's informed by a really generous and warm-hearted humanitarianism and humanism at its core, which puts people back at the center. Whether or not, you know, you agree with the specific kinds of solutions or the specific kind of society that she might want, I think that's the key thing, is to bring the focus back to us, and we us are be able to build communities together. And that can use technology, right? There's no reason. I'm not advocating getting rid of technology at all. The same way I'm not advocating getting rid of politics. But I think we need to make both of those things work for us. And neither politics should dominate, nor should technology become a method by which everything happens.
Problemet med de tekniske løsninger er, at de er politiske. Mark Zuckerberg fra Facebook mener for eksempel, at Facebook skulle lede verden meget bedre, end politikerne kan. Dermed ender vi med at dele verden op i politik versus et techno-community, kunne vi kalde det. Og med de politikere, vi har i dag, så kommer det sidste til at se meget attraktivt ud. Måske er det bedre end Trump, tænker vi. Jeg tror ikke, at Zuckerberg vil være præsident, men han mener bestemt, at han ville kunne gøre det bedre. Men det er ikke et demokrati, han tilbyder. Det er der ingen af tech-firmaerne, der gør, siger altså David Wood. Wood er egentlig med her for at tale om smarte byer. Og hvordan ser han egentlig dem udfolde sig fremover med blandt andet Palantirs overvågningssystemer hængende over sig?
I mean, one of the things, specific things about policing technology and the way that policing technology is going is that most of these predictive policing platforms just don't work. And this is the big secret of a lot of this stuff. It doesn't work. And people like Predpol and other kinds of companies, HunchLab and so on, who are producing these products, I can't speak specifically about Palantir's products because they seem to be quite effective in other situations, and that's one of the problems. But many of these products simply do not deliver on the promises they provide. You know, they say a lot of them really just about accumulating existing data and assuming that crime will occur where this previous sets of crime have done, and it's an assumption. And unfortunately, it's an assumption that as soon as a crime occurs where that hasn't been predicted, starts to unravel. So a lot of those things they're in trouble right now. A lot of those companies. There's been a lot of trials of those systems, and they're being shown to be wanting. Now the thing is, the big problem is that just because they fail, it doesn't mean people are going to stop buying them. And this is one of the big problems of contemporary tech markets, and particularly the way that states and police forces buy technology. it's not because they succeed. It's because that these police forces have to be seen to be keeping up with the latest kinds of things that are happening internationally. And a lot of these police forces, they send their tech officers or their middle-ranking policy people to all these international conferences of other police officers, and they all share in this kind of joint education about what the best is, what the latest thing is. So there's a kind of common culture emerging globally amongst police officers about what should be done in policing. And this is really getting dominated by technology companies. I mean, they're providing the demonstrations at these events, they're sponsoring these events. They often provide the software or the hardware free to police forces under certain conditions. And of course, you know, who turns down free stuff, right? This is the same with smart cities, right? A lot of smart city technology, the offer is, we give you this stuff. You know, and cities are desperate for funding right now. In the era of neoliberalism, where there's been a rollback of municipal funding away from, and a rollback of power, actually, from municipal level in general, that cities are losing power, losing funding. And free stuff. You know, it's a really seductive argument that we can provide you with free things that will solve some of the problems that you've got in your city, whether it's policing security problem, whether it's, you know, like Sidewalk Labs in Toronto is offering essentially to solve everything, you know, everything, housing, the weather even. They've even actually said they will actually have like heated sidewalks that will change the local conditions, so, you know, it'll be less horrible in the winter in Toronto. And, you know, so when you get an offer like that a technological platform offered to you as a gift, you know, will then solve your problems, especially if you're in a condition of austerity and of municipal funding rollback, you're going to take it. That, again, is that's another really difficult thing to fight, to say to people, don't take this free gift. You know, people look at you like you're crazy. What do you mean? Why should we not have this free system? The problem is, we've got to actually, I think, start opening this idea of the gift up and saying, what is the price we're paying? Who's paying? Somebody's paying. And in the case of something like Sidewalk Labs in Toronto, every single person who interacts with that system once it's created will be paying, because all of their data is essentially being harvested. So it's not just then the Google will not just be absorbing all the online data from people, but it will have real world data from people. So, you know, Google adds to its enormous trove of data that it has on the entire world, and can actually start to basically simulate life.
Tech-firmaerne elsker smarte byer. Googles underfirma Sidewalk Labs bygger for tiden deres helt egen by ved Torontos havnefront, hvor de lover beboerne, at de har styr på sikkerhed, orden og sågar vejret, det sidste via opvarmede fortove, når vinteren er hårdest. Det meste af alt det, der tilbydes her, det er tilsyneladende gratis. Til gengæld får Google adgang til beboernes virkelige fysiske liv, ikke kun det, de lever foran computerne.
They have a system now called Replica, which they are essentially feeding with all of this data from real-world interactions and online interactions combined together, mobile phone data and so on. And the idea is they can completely simulate, in this case at the moment, traffic patterns, but the idea is much more in the future, and create a total simulation of a place. And again, this is extremely attractive to city planners and so on, that you could actually, you know, essentially not just like contemporary predictive policing models, just sort of have an idea about where things are going, but have a more mobile, moving, sort of ongoing simulated mapping system that will tell you really precisely what things happen when and how you should work with them. The problem is, I think, with that is that the simulation starts to take over the real. You know, I think the real world is expected to somehow conform to this simulation, and what happens when it doesn't. And it's quite likely, I think, that if these kinds of simulations, these models, come into more widespread use, that things that do not happen according to the model will be seen as abnormal, or, you know, things that shouldn't happen.
Crime.
Yeah. Well, like, it's not just crime, though. I mean, just being in the wrong place. You know, if people are in somewhere they're not supposed to be according to the simulation, you know, what do you do in that case? You either perfect the simulation. The other option is you just change the city a bit to stop that kind of thing from happening. And this is when you get into a more, you know, a society which basically runs for technology, not with technology. And this is happening increasingly. You know, cities change the design of, you know, just the way that things like crossings on roads work in order to make sure that people move in certain directions. This has happened for a very long time. But this kind of thinking starts to intrude on more areas of life. So the city itself is kind of managing you more and more.
So the simulation, we are becoming the simulation.
Well, there was a, you know, a social philosopher, Jean Baudrillard, who sort of said this back in the 80s, that essentially, I mean, he was quoted in The Matrix, right? Go back to The Matrix, the film, you know, he's one of the big inspirations behind a lot of pop culture stuff about conspiracy and so on. But his basic way of thinking about this was, yes, that all of these kinds of technologies are creating a simulation of society, which becomes what he called a simulacrum, a replacement, essentially, for society based on the simulation. And he said that's already happening back in the 80s. You know, if he was living today, I think he'd be just sitting there going, yeah, I told you so, this is happening. And yeah, it's true. I mean, you know, I think that is one of the problems with what I call ambient government, or what we might call techno sort of government of any kind, is this idea that somehow if you create a system to predict and model, then people have to start conforming to the system and not the other way around. Otherwise, it doesn't work.
Google, de har allerede et program, de kalder Replika, som de hælder alle data ind i, så de kan simulere alle steder i verden. Og det er et meget attraktivt program for byplanlæggere og for politi, der ønsker at arbejde med såkaldt predictive policing, hvor man foregriber forbrydelser, ligesom i filmen Minority Report. Simulationer som Replika overtager langsomt virkeligheden. Byerne ændres for at gøre simulationen perfekt. Det er byen, der styrer dig, ikke omvendt. Vi bliver simulationer selv, ligesom i The Matrix, siger David Murakami Woods. Og i simulationen, der er vi helt alene.
One of the things I was just one of the thoughts I had this morning was that every time I let a machine kind of handle something, if I say that okay, this I have some AI that can do this decision from me, then I don't have to have this responsibility to other people myself. But at the same time, I'm also saying that other people don't need to have responsibility for me. Which means that I'm more lonely, and I'm suddenly a person who is myself subject to machines.
Yeah, I mean, that's very true. I think Professor Zuboff's book points this out. There's been a lot of writing about loneliness recently. George Monbiot in The Guardian has been writing a lot about this, the age of loneliness, and it's not entirely because of technology. You know, this kind of alienation from your labor, alienation from yourself, it's part of Marx. I mean, but Durkheim was talking about anomie back in the 1900s. You know, it's not entirely new. And I think ever since the advent of industrial society, we've had this kind of separation of people from, first, the kind of removal of people from the communities in which they were living, you know, forcing people into factories, that kind of thing, which, you know, but then also factories themselves, they force people to work in certain ways that are inauthentic, that remove them from their sources of self-worth. But now, of course, yeah, you're right, we have another layer. Another layer which says that, in fact, it doesn't even have to be you who interacts with other people or things. I mean, the advent of intelligent agents and various kinds of personal assistants and so on, which mediate between us and other people, not just in a kind of passive way, so we're just receiving, like with former kinds of technology. These are active technologies that essentially model us, learn our preferences, behave for us, and then we just let them loose out in the world to do things. You know, you can imagine, I think, and science fiction writers have long imagined, a society in which only these agents exist. They just interact with each other, and you know, they would never know. You know, in some cases, human beings become kind of irrelevant or not necessary anymore for the functioning of those systems. That's the kind of really dystopic view that, you know, that somehow, you know, there could be a completely dead space on Earth with only machines talking to each other. Imagining forever that they're serving something that doesn't exist anymore. I mean, that's the really dystopic view, but I think you're right. I think the short to medium term implication is a kind of new super or hyper alienation from our authentic selves, if we can really understand such a thing. But you know, and certainly an alienation from each other, increasing loneliness, further breakdown of any kinds of authentic bonds of community, friendship, love, these kind of things.
Teknologien simulerer os, og vi ender med at blive totalt fremmedgjorte fra vores autentiske selv. I Japan, der er man for eksempel gået videre end bare online dating på Tinder. Her kan man være regulært kæreste med en computerskabt partner, og det er der mange, der er i flere år, og det accelererer vores allesammens adskillelse.
I mean, one of the things I'm really concerned about I've been seeing this a lot in Japan, where I spend a lot of time, is the increasing prevalence of virtual dating systems and virtual partners. So this is not just online dating. This is actually games and online systems where people interact with entirely created entities. They're not real, but yet they have relationships, supposedly, and I mean relationships in inverted commas here, with these entities lasting years. In some cases, people claim to have married, you know, and one of these kind of virtual partners. And some people say, well, so what? It makes people happy. You know, these people couldn't interact with human beings in a normal way. But in some ways, that it accelerates that sort of separation where, you know, people who are already alienated from society, the only answer is for them to be completely alienated from society. It's not that we should take people back in. We should make efforts to recreate community, to bring some kind of, you know, sensitivity and sensibility to bear on these problems. We should just cut them off completely, give them some technology and tell them to go away and leave them to be happy in these solipsistic virtual relationships that, you know, have no human content. It's human in the sense of pre-programmed content, right? There's no authenticity to that. That really troubles me. And, you know, for some people, it'd say, well, why does it trouble you? It's very hard to explain why that should bother you, right? Because maybe that person is happy. You know, am I saying I should take away this person's happiness because it doesn't seem authentic to me? And it's a very difficult argument to actually have, but I think if you base it on this individualistic idea that somehow it's only about some individual's temporary consumer-based happiness, yeah, that's difficult to argue, but that, I don't think that's the kind of argument we should be having. We should be talking about collectivity, about sociality, about community, humanity. I'm wary of the term humanity to some extent just because it masks a lot of, you know, already existing divisions and prejudices. And, you know, there's a sense in which some of these tech critique kinds of books, it's almost like they're, you know, this is a little bit mischievous, and I'm not applying this to Shoshana Zuboff's book at all, but some of these books, it's almost like you might as well call these books White People Discover Prejudice, right? Suddenly we're worried that, you know, that agencies are discriminating, you know, against us. It's like, well, there are people in the world this has been happening to for hundreds, thousands of years, right? There's a lot of people who understand these kinds of sorting systems very well indeed, right? You know, these systems have resulted in people being slaves, being subject to genocide. You know, it's one level, it's like you can understand people being a little bit skeptical about suddenly people like me, you know, white, middle-aged, middle-class people suddenly saying, oh, look at all this terrible prejudice that's happening through technology, this sorting, this discrimination. It's like they're probably sitting there nodding and going, yep, welcome to the world, you know. It's like, but, you know, I think that's a first step to realize that, you know, this is not something entirely new, but in order to make humanity mean something, we've got to step further. I don't think we assume humanity to begin with. In some ways, we've already kind of lost, we don't speak for humanity. We've lost that right a long time ago, but we have to together, and that means people listening to people, listening to all the ways in which people have interacted with these technological systems and want to interact with them, rebuild a sense of what humanity means, you know, with, against whichever one happens to be the case, technology, and according to what kinds of technologies we need or want. So it's about rebuilding. It's not about assuming things already exist or assuming that we're part of something without, you know, without kind of further thought, but rebuilding or building something completely new, I think, maybe.
Immens og hele tiden, der hænger efterretningstjenesterne over os. De passer på os, beskytter os mod terror, men de trænger os ind i vores liv og påvirker os. Jeg spurgte David Murakami Woods, der har en Ph.D. i NSA, om hvad det er, der er sket med efterretningstjenesterne siden Edward Snowdens afsløringer.
One of the last times we were talking about you have a PhD in the NSA and in what they were doing, and we've been talking about Edward Snowden and his revelation, and that has been a big topic all over Europe about what has been going on here. Now we are discussing automation as the big thing currently. Do you see any connections between the two, except because all of it of course touches on privacy in many ways, but where did for example, where did the agencies go now? Have they just gone away, or what has happened?
Not at all. I mean, This is funny. One of the things about these kinds of revelations, and one of the benefits of having done research on the history of the NSA, is that you see this happening again and again. Like, there are moments of revelation. There was such a moment in the late 60s, early 70s, when the Minaret, Project Minaret, was discovered in the United States, when the NSA and the FBI were collaborating to create databases and watch lists of activists and anybody who was a threat, supposedly, to the government. There were congressional inquiries. There were, you know, massive coverage. It led to the creation of, in the USA, of the Federal Intelligence Surveillance Court, you know, supposed new oversight. And then everybody forgot about it again. Did the NSA stop doing what it was doing? Did it go away? Did it get less powerful? On the contrary. In fact, through the 80s, it grew much more powerful. And then in the late 80s, early 90s, we rediscovered, again, the terrible things that the NSA was doing. You know, we rediscovered Echelon. And, of course, Europeans know this very well, the network of American military intelligence bases that was spread across various countries in Europe. You know, that was another moment of revelation. And then people went to sleep again. Did the NSA go away? Did it get less powerful? No, again, on the contrary. And, you know, by the time you get to 9/11, you've got the extraordinary expansion of these powers in ways that people had never imagined, the extraordinary expansion of the geographical scope of what agencies like the NSA, and of course it's not just the NSA, with all its allies, with all its connections, which include now multiple countries around the world, places you would never expect to be involved in these networks. You know, as, of course, Angela Merkel even discovered, even her own intelligence agencies were involved in this without her knowing, supposedly. And that's, I think, pretty common. So then we have, you know, new series of revelations in the 2000s, and there's people like William Binney and Drake and others who come up with really high-level revelations. And again, it gets forgotten within a couple of years. Then we have Snowden. Now, I don't want to make out that Snowden was somehow unique, because the whole point of talking about these other previous whistleblowers, and there are lots of others, I haven't mentioned Margaret Neusham and others who, you know, really should be better remembered in this, and I think they get forgotten. The reason for mentioning these people is that this is an ongoing process, and we should not forget every time, but we do. Part of it's that, I'm not going to blame the media, but part of it's the way that the attention of the media shifts from one thing to the other, because, you know, we get bored of things, people read and watch things, we get bored, people listen to things. But, you know, there needs to be people who keep the focus on this, and I mean, you're one of them, but there are, I think, too few journalists who do keep the focus on these issues. But Snowden is showing a surprising persistence in our consciousness. Partly it's because he personally hasn't gone away. So he's, you know, still there jabbing away and, you know, pointing out things. And you know, he's, whatever's behind his continuing prominence, I don't really mind. You know, it's, you know, people assume, because he's in Russia, in the USA, they just assume he's a Russian agent. You know, it's just, it's an assumption. It's amazing how many Americans just think he defected to Russia, which is not at all what happened. But even if he did, I didn't even care, to be honest, that much. It's like he's a constant reminder to people that, you know, this has been going on. And the more he actually just keeps jabbing in that way, the more that people, you know, can't forget. But we've got to bear in mind, his revelations were not, and it's interesting to call them revelations, of course, in some ways they didn't reveal as much as we think they did. Most of that stuff was around in fragments already, but it did put things together in a completely new way and add a whole layer of different new information. But it's a tiny amount of what the NSA was doing. The assumption is that this was a lot of material, and it is, if you look at the amount of documents, the huge amount of stuff that's still being sorted through by researchers. But this was a small percentage of a few months of training documents, largely from the NSA, from 1 year. It's a minute amount of the kind of material that's out there that intelligence agencies have access to and create. It's, you know, people forget what it didn't have in it. There was very little in the revelations about, for example, the satellite systems that any of these agencies operate. There was very little about completely other different. It was all, you know, mainly on communications networks, in particular kinds of systems. And so we assume we know a lot more now about them, and we do, but it doesn't mean we know anything like a large amount. And I think that's worth bearing in mind. We should have some humility about what we know about these agencies. It's not as much as we think we do. So that's the first thing to say. I think also, have they gone away again? No, they haven't. Have they lessened in their influence? No, they haven't. And, you know, it's interesting to see now, in a situation with a president in the USA who quite clearly doesn't trust these agencies, that essentially they're going more underground again. You know, they don't disappear or back off when they're confronted by someone like Trump. They just go back to what they've always done, which is, you know, sneaky, underhand stuff. That's their job, right? Their job is to survive and protect the state in a deeper sense than is represented by Trump. This is why they do not conform to what any president says. They'll take a... If the president gives them power, they'll take it. But they won't stop doing things when a president tells them not to. They won't take criticism from a president about what they should or shouldn't do. They'll just carry on doing it in a different way under the surface. And that's what some people call the deep state. I don't like that phrase because it sort of implies some unchangeable, impossible thing. But there's certainly a continuity that agencies like that offer that we need to keep an eye on, and we need to keep them in the spotlight.
Efterretningstjenesterne er blevet afsløret gang på gang med Echelon og med Snowden, men de er naturligvis bare fortsat med at opføre sig, som de plejer. Og med en præsident som Donald Trump i USA, der ikke kan lide dem og ikke stoler på dem, så er de faktisk blevet endnu mere hemmelighedsfulde. De er gået under jorden, om man så må sige, men de er ikke væk. De er endnu stærkere end før, og vi skal holde godt øje med dem, siger altså David Murakami Woods. Vi har talt om Facebook, Google og de andre tech-giganter, og nu altså også om efterretningstjenesterne. Men kan man sige, at de i virkeligheden er det samme, at de arbejder på samme måde, måske?
Before this, we've been discussing the role of Facebook and Peter Thiel and stuff like that. They also, could we compare the way Facebook actually works is that the same way as the NSA?
Well, it's not just a matter of comparison. These things are all connected. I mean, there's a lot of evidence, and there's some writing about this in Professor Zuboff's book, that the agencies like the NSA and the CIA were quite surprised when social networks started to emerge. And especially, even though organizations like Google were originally funded, the PhD that set up, you know, essentially led to Google being set up, was funded by a joint CIA-NSA project. Nafees Ahmed's research has shown that, right? And there's even some evidence that, the supervisor of the original PhD was a CIA asset, but that's another whole story. You might not want to broadcast that. But, you know, there's certainly, you know, these organizations, Silicon Valley has been intimately connected to military intelligence funding systems. It doesn't mean that what they produced was all organized by the military. The idea was to give them stuff and let them run out and invent things. And then, of course, to reintegrate those things that were produced. So what happens, and what one of the things that the Snowden revelations did show, was the way in which technology companies were reintegrated into the system at various stages, and that all the things they were produced were sort of brought back in various ways. You know, part of this has been through agencies essentially building systems that piggyback on social networks and use open source intelligence. The CIA has bought up numerous companies that do sort of social media scraping and analysis. You know, they're private companies, they were developed through private money, and eventually, if they're really good enough, really useful enough, the CIA will essentially buy them up to bring them in-house if they don't buy their products. And of course, there's a continuous traffic between the private sector and these intelligence agencies. I mean, Palantir is a really good example of this. You know, these are highly connected to different national state intelligence and policing organizations. Not just clients, you know, they're connected much deeper than that. People from these agencies, you know, go to work for private companies. They found private companies, and then those products get brought back. It's a continuous process like that. I'm not saying it's all some kind of conspiracy, but it's more like it's a kind of society, right? That's their society, and that sort of you might call it the intelligence community, as they do, but I hesitate to use the word community for this kind of thing. But it's, you know, it is its own world, and the norms of that world are not our own. And so, yeah, Facebook is integrated into those systems. Of course it is. You know, even companies like Apple, which are supposedly the champions of privacy, and people keep telling us these are the good companies, you know, they signed up to these things too, right? You know, if you look at the documents to show who got involved in Prism when, there's Apple's on the list. I mean, Microsoft was first, because it always is. I mean, Microsoft was first with the Echelon systems way back when. They just, you know, always just bow first to the intelligence agencies. But, you know, Google's there, Apple's there, they're all there. And it doesn't matter. It's not just the Western intelligence agencies. We can see now with what Google's doing in China. They'll make some token protests a little bit. They'll say, we don't really want to do this. We don't want to, you know, censor our systems for that. They'll leave it a few months and then they'll do it. Because, you know, it's just they can't not have a foothold in that space. And then, of course, as soon as they do that, they become a tool of that set of intelligence agencies and organizations. They put their tools at the services of those organizations to some extent. So that's another kind of very, very serious issue. They're not separate entirely. They're interconnected. They're not coordinating in that sense, but they're very much interconnected.
Det, der er sket nu, er, at CIA og NSA simpelthen udnytter de data, som sociale medier suger op. De er nærmest smeltet sammen til én enhed. Det er ikke nogen sammensværgelse. Det er bare efterretningsverdenen generelt, og Facebook og Google er fuldt integreret i den verden. Det står klart og tydeligt i Snowdens Prism-papirer. Men det betyder ikke noget rigtigt. Se bare, hvad Google lover i Kina. De protesterer lidt, men så giver de sig, og så bliver de et værktøj for den kinesiske regering. Men hvad skal vi gøre ved det hele, tænker jeg? Er der nogle løsninger, og hvordan kommer vi videre? Her er Murakami radikal. Han tror ikke på privacy by design, eller etiske kodekser, eller etisk computeropførsel. Det kommer ikke til at virke. Måske skal man længere ud. Måske skal de store firmaer simpelthen fysisk brydes op, og staten have kontrollen tilbage. Det er de nemlig bange for, de store tech-firmaer, siger altså David Wood.
Well, you know, I sometimes tell people in a half-joking way that, you know, the guillotine was a very good idea. You know, I'm not entirely joking about that, in the sense that what I mean is I think we need something far more decisive as an intervention, far more revolutionary, to use that term. I don't think, you know, kind of nice forms of engagement have worked. I don't think it's worked that we sit down with technology companies and we sit down with governments and say, it would be better if you do this, or might you think about doing something a little differently? You know, a code of practice would be really nice, and then, you know, we could embed privacy by design in your systems and everything will be fine. All of these kind of solutions that use the same, basically, ways of thinking that the organizations we're trying to control already subscribe to. The problem is we don't actually want those ways of thinking, right? And we've got to overturn not just a political economic system, but also all of these ways of thinking, all of these ideologies that drive it. They've got to be challenged and overturned. That means something far more revolutionary. You know, I think in the European Union, we heard last night Paul Nemitz and others talking about, you know, actually bringing some things back under state control, about using antitrust laws, breaking up companies. And, you know, this is one thing that some of these companies really fear. I think it's a reasonable alternative. We're not saying there shouldn't be innovation. On the contrary, actually, the capitalist should accept the logic of having more companies with an ability to innovate in a more competitive market. Surely that's exactly what they want, right?
Hvis valget står mellem to alternativer, at vi bryder de store techfirmaer op til mere håndterbare størrelser og dermed får dem under statslig kontrol, eller at en rasende folkemængde møder op i Googles hovedkvarter og kræver chefens hoved på en pind, så tror jeg, at de vil foretrække det sidste. Vi er nødt til at genopbygge internettet. Internettet skal være netværkernes netværk. Men vi har glemt at bygge lokale nærnetværk, siger altså David Murakami Woods.
You know, the internet in its name should be the network of networks, the thing that connects networks together. What we've forgotten is how we build local networks. We've put everything, not everything has to be global, right? We can connect local networks together to make a global network that is people-centered. And I think that was, you know, that's in the name of the internet. In the sense, we have to rebuild the internet. In some ways, to build a new internet. It's not literally building a new internet, but it's, you know, it's repurposing those things we have, starting in some ways from ground up.
Og det var altså David Murakami Woods, professor i sociologi ved Queen's University, Ontario, Canada. Med det, så er aflyttet forbi for i dag. Jeg hedder Anders Kjærulf, og vi vender naturligvis tilbage næste uge med mere nyt fra det der overvågningssamfund, som vi læner os godt tilbage i og trækker VR-brillerne tættere på og lukker øjnene derinde i det hvide lys, mens vi drømmer om sandheden i en sjæl og et legeme. Det bliver ikke lige nu, men måske om lidt. Call connected to the NSA. Complete transmission to the NSA. Suspending your rights for the duration of